This week on Potlatch, Billy Johnson representing the 13th Regional Corporation, Tony Vasca of Bethel, Richard Frank of Minto, and George Manuel of the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. Part of this program consists of excerpts of the recent Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage. One of the speakers represented Alaska Natives who now live in the lower 48 states.
My name is Billy D. Johnson. I am a shareholder in the 13th Regional Corporation, elected to the Board of Directors, elected as Chairman of the Land Committee. The 13th Regional Corporation was created by the Alaska Native Settlement Claims Act. The leadership of the 13th Region are dedicated to increasing the value of the shareholder stock. Our investment program is reaching into Alaska. The 13th Region created and owns the North Sea Fishery Corporation, which is in the process of creating a large fishing and crabbing fleet. Four boats now in this corporation, two wholly owned and two with joint venture ownership with the vessel's captain. These vessels are crabbing off the coast of Alaska. We are also venturing into the field of construction. Our construction firm, Alaska House Movers Incorporation, purchases homes, moves them to other locations for resale. These are some of our investment projects. We also have created a nonprofit corporation structured to help our people in the lower 48, no matter which corporation they belong to, on their social service needs. The 13th Regional Corporation, with sanctions from the board, is conducting a vigorous campaign to obtain federal lands which we are not afforded by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, under the direction of the chairman, myself. We are not seeking to disturb the pattern laid on by ANCSA. Our legislative draft clearly spells out the selection rights of the 13th region. Our selection rights would not infringe on the rights created by ANCSA. We do not seek the lands that have been selected or in the process of being selected by the 12 regional corporations or by the village corporations. We are not asking for lands selected or in the process of being selected by the state of Alaska. We will not upset the 7I section of the Act simply by non-participation. After meeting with the Secretary of the Interior, Andrus, the position of the Department of Interior was an inequity created by the Act when the 13th region was not given land rights, although the government extinguished our Aboriginal titles and rights to the state of Alaska. The subcommittee and the full committee of the Interior and Insular Affairs of Congress, the ones that will hear our plea, are fully informed at this moment of our intentions. One of the greatest fears, apparently by the 12 regional corporations as I see it, that somehow if the 13th region is given land, we may cause more problems for them if our lands are adjacent to theirs. There is no problem that is insurmountable. We are reasonable people. Some people say that we had an opportunity to opt out of the 13th into a land owner corporation in Alaska. I say, why didn't they give us land first, then an opportunity to opt in and opt out? Of the total enrollment of the Alaska Claims Settlement Act, 20% are non-resident Alaska Natives. 15% have enrolled into one of the 12 Alaska-based corporations. So 15% of the non-resident Alaska Natives enjoy land rights. 5% belong to certain regions are exempt from land benefits. The 13 regions say that an inequity was created by ANCTA when we were not afforded land rights. We must correct this with an amendment to the Act. You must remember, we Alaska Natives in the 13th region are your brothers and your sisters. The same blood that runs in our veins runs in yours. It is time for us to work together. Our efforts to gain land for our shareholders is part of an ongoing project, which I will pursue continuously until the issue is resolved.
Another speaker at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention was Tony Vasca from the Bethel area.
One of the most difficult things to realize in trying to work through a conference whose theme is, does one way of life have to die so another can live, is to realize that education does play a large part in that survival. In the last several months, the Department of Education, State Board of Education, Office for Civil Rights, and a bunch of other people have been working and are continuing to work for a comprehensive bilingual bicultural education program. Initially, there was a handbook which the Office for Civil Rights and the State Board of Education and the Department of Education agreed to as minimum guidelines. They were proposed to the State Board of Education. Hearings were held throughout the state, as most of you know, and the Department of Education rewrote the 217 pages of proposed guidelines to 11 pages. On reviewing the new regulations for bilingual bicultural education, you find a lot of deficiencies that give local school committees no power in deciding what kind of bilingual bicultural programs should be going on throughout the state. Instead, the decision is left up to the discretion of the district superintendent. The new regulations are very vague in trying to establish a comprehensive bilingual bicultural education program. While we are worried about legislation concerning D2 land, outer continental shelf, coastal zone management, and other very important concerns, right here at home, we are fighting for our own language rights. The superintendent of the district came out with a position paper that opposed the handbook because it gave local control to not only the community school committee, but also to bilingual, bicultural school committees. How much more local control on that can you have? The Office for Civil Rights, Region 10, Seattle, and the Office for Civil Rights, Washington, D.C., have been fighting to make sure that the state of Alaska is in compliance for offering Alaska Natives equal opportunity in education. The state of Alaska has fallen far short of providing equal opportunity for Alaska Native children. There are no provisions in the regulations that say that the school district must have bilingual, bicultural education. We need more involvement from as many of the Alaska Natives as possible to ensure that proper, comprehensive, aggressive, bilingual, bicultural education programs are part of the regular educational programs in Alaska. The funding system, according to the new regulations, is based on grant applications, which relegates bilingual bicultural education to a special program, an added-on program to the regular educational program. What we need is a bilingual bicultural program that is part of the regular program on a foundation funding formula, not a grant application formula. We need a lot of help now, and presently the OCR, the Office for Civil Rights, and the State of Alaska Department of Education are negotiating to ensure that proper bilingual bicultural education programs are going on. And we seek your support for a comprehensive bilingual bicultural program. Thank you.
big rubber tie you had. I'm going down to bring my baby back. It's hot times in old town, downtown tonight. Hot times in old town tonight.
Mississippi John Hunt singing Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight. Andrew Isaac of Dot Lake won the Alaska Federation of Natives Citizen of the Year Award. Richard Frank of Minto accepted the award for him.
Doron in our language means the chief. He is a traditional chief. He always has been striving for education of the younger people. He calls all the native people his children, and he's been very instrumental in the native land claims before it really started. I've talked many times with him, and he converges in his native tongue, and a very likable fellow. He always expressed not only his tribe, but the general native people of Alaska, and also if he can be of help to the people in the lower 48. Well, he provides that.
Loggins and Messina. As far as I know, George Manuel did not attend the Alaska Federation of Native Convention, but he did attend the Inuit Circumpolar Conference in Barrow as a representative of the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. A native of British Columbia in Canada, Manuel describes this international organization.
It's people, the original people of a country who is not part and parcel of the government that's in existence. And at the present time, we represent Aboriginal people or Indigenous people, as it is known in the United Nations, in countries in which they are either a minority, which don't form part of the national government, or a majority in a country which don't form part of the national government. We represent 19 countries from the Pacific. We have New Zealand, the Maoris of New Zealand, the Aborigines of Australia, and the Indians of Canada and the United States, and the Inuit from Greenland have been to our conferences, and from Alaska. We also have the Sami people from Scandinavia. And so altogether we represent approximately around 36 million people in this organization. We have a charter that has been adopted by the General Assembly, but yet has to be ratified by the various countries in itself, and some of the countries have already ratified it. Canada, for instance, has been ratified it. The United States has ratified it. The Maoris of New Zealand have ratified it. The Sami people of Scandinavia have ratified it. The Central American countries have ratified it. It's both a statement of rights and also a statement of how the organization is going to function. The principle of our struggle, of course, is our Aboriginal rights claims, education in our own terms, cultural retention on our terms. Those are the three major principles under which our charter stands. We have You know, the Scandinavian countries have formed a federation, and that way they tie into the World Council as a federation. That is the Finland, Norway, and Sweden. We also formed a federation in Central America consisting of 8 countries. Last winter, we helped bring the conference into being, and their wrestling also with their charter. And I think they're right in saying that they have to study their charter, and they have to also study our charter. So, you know, if they're thinking of tying in with the World Council, it has to have some confirmation in relation to how the two charters you know, fitting to each other.
Manuel describes the first meeting of the World Council of Indigenous Peoples.
It was held in Port Alberni under very tight security on October 27th to 31st in 1975. We didn't allow the media in, and one of the principal reasons we didn't allow the media in was because we had delegates from Central and South America that you know, their lives were in danger with whatever statements they may make at the conference. And in spite of the fact that we had very tight security, never let the press in, this is why it never got any publicity, most of the delegates from Paraguay ended up in jail. Some of the Colombian delegates ended up in jail. And one of the most prominent delegates from Bolivia ended up in jail. We just got him out. He's now living in Canada with no status at all. Now, this is the kind of, you know, oppression that we face with some of our members in our organization. We had a difficult time. The only way we could get the last person released was if we promised to take him out of the country, and that's what we were able to do. And we can't get him in the press if he's so scared to get any publicity, because in case his family gets, you know, tortured in the same way he was tortured in his own country.
Manuel comments on the importance of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference last June.
When I was doing a study to find out whether I can bring a world conference together, when I met the anti-slavery group and Survival International in England, they had been doing studies on this, and when I asked for their support, the reaction that I got from them was, well, you're not competent to do it. You know, Native people are never competent to do it, and I believe that when the Native people can pull a conference internationally like this, it is a sign that they can handle their own affairs. They can achieve their own objectives if they're given the support and the opportunity. And I think it's this kind of relationship among Native people and the kind of mentality that the non-Indian people have towards us is not been mature to be able to bring organizations. It is only these type of conferences that could prove that we can do whatever we want to do when we make up our minds to do it.
I asked George Manuel if his organization will expand later to Africa and to communist countries.
Well, I think anything is achievable. You know, it depends on how. Right now, as far as I'm concerned, we represent a paper organization and people who are desperate for an organization to acquire some of the goals to liberate themselves. And I don't think our organization has achieved any degree of power yet, you know, and that is our goal, and that is why we decided to organize on an international basis, is because we felt with numbers, because it takes two things, in my opinion, to achieve political power. One is money, and the other one is numbers. We haven't got the first one, and that is money, but certainly on a world basis, we have the numbers, and it is for this purpose, this goal in mind that we've decided to organize on an international basis. Now, Mike, my answer appears to be avoiding your question. As far as Africa is concerned, I guess they don't need us right at the present. Their kind of political struggle is far more potent than the present organization that we presently have brought into existence. As far as Russia is concerned, that we hope at some point that the native peoples of those countries, I was hoping that some representatives from those countries, for instance, would have been here, you know, the Inuits, I understand there are Inuits in Russia that should have been here to this conference. But those are the things that we have to overcome in a future work of developing an organization, a world organization. You know, there were 44 countries that applied to attend that conference, and because they haven't got the resources, only 19 countries attended. So you can see that there's really a lot of interest towards relating to a world organization as far as Native people are concerned. There's one thing that we have in common that's very, very clear, and that culturally we're the same. Our values are very much the same, and all the countries that came to the Port Alberni conference, all the delegates from the 19 countries agreed, including the Sami people of Scandinavia, in spite of the fact that the very white skin that you will notice here have a very common traditional culture, common history as far as culture is concerned. And to a very large degree, we've been oppressed. I think if you look at the Native people pretty well all over the world, you will find that they have another thing quite outstanding and common, and that is they're poor as a majority of people within their own traditional culture. You know, that we're poor and we have to bring we have to develop our own dependence within the framework of our own values.
Can you specify what culture similarities there are and what values there are in the various ethnic groups?
I think one of the things that we have lived in the past with is that the belief in working together in a communal basis, and I think we have very strong ethnic ties in this connection, and also the way we've been oppressed in the past, I think, is another good reason. When delegates from 19 countries assemble, it is very difficult, with all the different languages, it's very difficult to bring some kind of a united organization into existence. And one of the ways we broke the tensions, especially in Alberni, where the Indians from South America were highly suspicious of the American Indians that were attending that conference. They felt, you know, maybe they were tied in with the CIA or something like that. So the Maoris recommended to me that we had a cultural evening. And we did have a cultural evening in which the Maoris led it off, and the Aborigines from Australia, and then the Sami people from Scandinavia, that immediately knitted the people together. After that evening was over, there was no more tension. That's what made the World Council, was that one cultural evening that we had. There was a message there among people, and I think one of the Sami people mentioned there, and I think it's in one of our publications, we've been listening in the wind for this kind of message that now has emerged from this cultural evening.
What was the reaction to the other delegates upon seeing the Sami people, who, as you mentioned before, are white?
That's what created the greatest tension in the first 2 days of our conference, because especially from the Central American and South American delegates, they kept repeating over and over, here is our oppressor sitting in our old assembly, they relate the oppression to white skin people. And that's what was the principal part of creating the tension. But after that cultural evening was over, and after the Sami people showed their songs, and after they showed their dances, they realized from this experience that they had a lot in common, you know, a common bond that they're related with, and that's what created the unity that brought the founding conference together and brought the World Council of Indigenous People into existence.
What causes the oppressors to oppress the Indigenous people? Are there common threads of oppression and reasons for it?
I don't know. You'd have to tell me that, but I suspect that it's in terms of economics, in terms of greed based on individualism, based on status and so forth.
George Manuel, representing the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. This is Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening. Potlatch came to you from KUAC in Fairbanks. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting gave some of the money to produce this program.
From the University of Alaska, this has been a KUAC production.